KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Cross Pass.
All this hard work, all this investigation, all the efforts to bring justice and accountability have been erased.
By pardoning January 6th rioters, President Trump effectively wiped out the biggest federal case in U.S. history.
For Tuesday, January 21st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In many U.S. cities, immigrant communities are bracing for a mass deportation effort to begin.
We'll look at how people in Chicago are preparing.
We know it's coming, whether it takes a week, 2 weeks, and we let our guards down a little bit, but we know it's coming.
Later, Israel's ambassador to the U.N. takes our questions about the ceasefire in Gaza.
And remembering Jules Feiffer, who illustrated the classic children's book, The Phantom Tollbooth.
First of all, I was born in 1929 when all sorts of things happened. The Depression hit, but also the adventure comic strip hit.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump invited three executives to the White House today to announce a new venture known as Stargate. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, it is a large investment in artificial intelligence infrastructure.
The CEOs of SoftBank, OpenAI, and Oracle said 10 massive data centers that will be used to run AI technology are already under construction in Texas, and more could be possible. They praised Trump, and he in turn praised the multi-billion-dollar investment.
This monumental undertaking is a resounding declaration of confidence in America's potential under a new president. Let me be a new president. I didn't say it. They did.
Trump has a history of inviting executives to make splashy announcements like this one at the White House, though they haven't always lived up to the hype. Tamara Keith, NPR News, the White House.
Some of President Trump's executive actions could fundamentally change the U.S. immigration system. His supporters are celebrating moves they say will lower the number of illegal border crossings, while immigrant rights groups say they'll challenge the measures in court. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran reports.
Trump's executive actions range from sending the National Guard to the southern border to ending birthright citizenship. Dean Stein is president of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which advocates for tighter immigration laws.
So it's going to be a period of, you know, both conflict and battle, but it would be a mistake to underestimate the determination of Trump 2.0 in getting the borders under control and restoring some kind of common sense to the immigration system.
The ACLU has already filed a lawsuit over the end of birthright citizenship. The organization says it will prevail. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Washington.
Attorneys general from 22 states have also filed suit in federal court seeking to block an executive order that refuses to recognize U.S.-born children of immigrants without legal status as citizens. The action expected to be just the first in a number of suits looking to block some of President Donald Trump's newly announced initiatives. Even as dangerous high winds have returned to Southern California, increasing the possibility wildfires will spread further, word rain it may be in the forecast this weekend, but that is fueling another concern, the possibility of deadly mudslides in fire-scorched areas. L.A. Mayor Karen Bass ordered crews to begin preparations to shore up hillsides and install barriers to protect vulnerable neighborhoods.
The action plan I have directed our city public works bureaus to implement includes the installation of barriers, debris removal, and diverting runoff from our stormwater system and into our sewer system where it can be treated.
Several new wildfires have broken out there in recent days. Stocks rose after companies began reporting some better-than-expected profit numbers. The Dow was up 537 points today. You're listening to NPR. Severe winter weather is hitting parts of the U.S. that rarely see snow, and in some cases have little or no snow removal equipment. Snow is coating roadways today in Lake Charles, Louisiana, New Orleans, and Pensacola, Florida. They're expecting 5 to 6 inches of snow there. Airports in Houston suspended operations due to the storm. State Highway Department officials are warning people to stay off the roads. As of this afternoon, more than 2,000 flights had already been canceled nationwide, according to FlightAware. Garth Hudson, the last surviving member of beloved Roots Rock Ensemble, the band, has died. The Canadian musician was 87 years old. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has this remembrance.
Garth Hudson played keyboard and saxophone, but it was his way of playing the Lowry organ and the clavinet as leading instruments that gave the band its signature churchy, post-psychedelic sound. The band got their start as the backing instrumentalists for Ronnie Hawkins and, famously, Bob Dylan. But in 1968, they broke out with their debut solo album, Music from Big Pink. After their official dissolution in 1976, Hudson continued playing with different iterations of the band for decades. He gave his first public performance in years in 2023 at a house concert in upstate New York. Writer Harry Hugh told NPR that Hudson, quote, never lost that spark. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices moved lower today. Oil dropped $1.99 a barrel to $75.89 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In one of his first official acts, President Trump fulfilled a promise that defined his campaign, granting clemency to all of the more than 1,500 people charged in connection with the January 6th, 2021 attack on the Capitol.
Yeah, these are the hostages, approximately 1,500 for a pardon.
Yes.
Full pardon.
The action included pardons for nonviolent offenders along with those who assaulted police officers. Trump also commuted the sentences of 14 others, all of whom are linked to the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys, both far-right extremist groups. For more, NPR Justice correspondent Kerry Johnson is here, along with NPR investigative correspondent Tom Dreisbach. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Kerry, let's start with you. This was a massive criminal investigation, more than 1,500 cases, which Trump just ended. What happens now?
Already, we're seeing people being released from prisons and jails, including Enrique Tarrio. He's the former chairman of the far-right Proud Boys group, and he had been serving a prison term of 22 years. He's now free, according to his lawyer, Naib Hassan.
I can tell you Enrique is looking forward to moving forward with his life and being a productive member of society.
Several other members of the Proud Boys also won pardons, and some had their sentences commuted.
Explain the difference between these pardons and commutations.
The vast majority of people won full and complete pardons, meaning not only are they released from prison, but they get certain rights back, like voting or owning a firearm. Trump commuted or shortened the sentences of 14 other people, including Stuart Rhodes. He's the founder of the far-right Oath Keepers group. Rhodes was convicted of seditious conspiracy and sentenced to 18 years in prison. The judge said he was an ongoing threat to this country and the very fabric of our democracy. Stuart Rhodes was released early this morning. He's been spotted outside the D.C. jail this afternoon, waiting for the release of other defendants.
Tom, there had been a sense that Trump might pardon only the nonviolent defendants. Vice President J.D. Vance actually said, obviously, in his words, people who assaulted police should not be pardoned. But Trump pardoned with a broad brush. Remind people about the violence that day.
Yeah, rioters brought a lot of weapons. Pepper spray, bear spray, metal poles, bats, stolen police batons. Several actually had loaded handguns, though thankfully they did not shoot anyone. More than 140 police officers were injured. And in one of the most severe assaults that's really stuck with me, a rioter took a stun gun and drove it into the neck of police officer Michael Fanone. He then suffered a heart attack. He was worried he was going to be killed. Multiple officers have described being crushed, feeling choked by the pepper spray, thinking they are about to die. And some rioters celebrated the violence, like Ryan Nichols. He wore a bulletproof vest on January 6th. He was armed with a crowbar. He pleaded guilty to spraying police officers in the face with pepper spray. And on the night of January 6th, so after the riot, he recorded himself calling for a second American revolution.
So if you want to know where Ryan Nichols stands, Ryan Nichols stands for violence. Ryan Nichols is done allowing his country to be stolen. And I understand that the first Revolutionary War, folks, it was violent. Well, guess what? This second Revolutionary War right now, the American Revolutionary War that's going on right now, it started today. It's going to be violent.
That was Ryan Nichols on January 6th. He was sentenced later to 5 years in prison, and now he is among those violent defendants who received.
the immigrants. By lunch, some customers trickle in, and every time that door opens, Caridad looks alarmed. The younger staff, they could run, but she says she's too old for that. And besides, she's been told by activists not to run.
No voy a correr, porque es peor para mí.
It's worse if you run, she says. I'm not a criminal. I'm not going to run. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, Chicago.
Strong winds are in the forecast for Southern California this week, and firefighters put out several small fires yesterday and today. So far, nothing like the giant blazes that forced tens of thousands to evacuate 2 weeks ago. Many are still displaced from their homes in L.A., but a few people have been sticking it out in the disaster zones. Katie Riddle reports.
A lot of this neighborhood in Altadena is charred black, blocks of it. But this street looks mostly okay from the outside. Rob Caves and his fiance have been staying here at their house. Many of the homes around them are still standing, but empty. Caves looks out from his doorway. He's holding a clipboard.
So this is my neighborhood watch list. I've got the name and the address and the status.
Status, which houses have pets in them, which need to be checked on, the ones that are gone altogether. Caves leans in his doorway as he reads the list. In some cases, they've had to inform their neighbors that they lost everything.
That was a super hard text or phone conversation to have because, you know, I try to be as emotionally present for them as I can be, but there's like, how do you say that to someone?
Caves and his fiance, Ralph Mendoza, did initially evacuate in the middle of the night.
Inside the house, smoke. Outside the house, smoke. Explosions everywhere. It's just panic everywhere.
A few hours later, they decided to chance it and return. Soon after, the National Guard closed off access to the neighborhood. They've been here ever since. Now, the city is easing the evacuation orders. But even if people want to return, many houses are still just not livable. They do have some utilities. The internet and power is intermittent, but it's not comfortable and possibly not safe.
We're not even using the water to even shower because we're afraid that there might be still some chemicals.
They've got each other as well. More than one person here reports being alone in their house. Earlier on this day, a friend brought Mendoza and Caves a bag of hamburgers. Now they're giving them out to the few neighbors who are around.
In and out. We got you in and out. Oh, no,
Michael Russell is one of these folks.
Thank you so much.
We got you.
That's awesome.
Russell lives across the street. His backyard is a tiny utopia, preserved, with a lemon and an orange tree, a stunning mountain view. He gestures to a ladder in the middle of the yard. This is where he watched the fire progress toward his house.
And then got up on it. You can see the burn side, the mountainside there. And then it was crazy. Winds are going like 50.
Last year, Russell took some steps to mitigate risk, removing flammable material from around the house, putting a fire-resistant mesh inside the vents and the roof. There were some things he didn't anticipate, like ash.
I really didn't realize how many carcinogens are in it and how dangerous it could potentially be. It's really freaking me out. I mean, you come inside my house, come on.
Inside, the house is covered in an almost invisible layer of black soot. The day before, Russell says he set an open cup of milk on the counter. When he was making coffee, he left for a half hour.
Would there be a milk line here? It was black.
A black line of ash covered the top of the milk. He's afraid to clean anything for fear he'll stir up dangerous chemicals.
So that's in the carpet. Yeah. It's in the bedding. I can't deep clean all this stuff to get this stuff out.
He plans to stick around, but he says he has no idea how to figure out what is toxic and how to make his house safe. Authorities are starting to give guidance on this. His neighborhood's emptiness is eerie.
So it's kind of living in a kind of a death zone in some ways. And I went out the other day, and as we're going through some neighborhoods in my truck, another cadaver dogs are out there.
On the metric of misery, Michael Russell counts himself lucky. He has a house. It is still standing. But the flip side of his good luck is all the uncertainty of what happens next. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Altadena.
This is NPR News.
Mariachi and rap come together in Kendrick Lamar's latest album, GNX. The voice behind that mariachi music is Deyda Barrera. She talks about the songs that move her and her collaboration with this year's Super Bowl halftime headliner tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. The love and hate is definite without a cure. All this talk is made.
Oh.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, views of the inauguration from far outside Washington.
We don't want to leave here agonizing. We must be organizing. It is not just about resistance. It is about persistence.
Plus, remembering musician Garth Hudson.
First, these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The leaders of the far-right extremist groups, the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, are out of prison one day after President Trump issued sweeping pardons for 1,500 people who were charged in the January 6th insurrection. NPR's Windsor Johnson says the move is drawing outrage from police officers who were defending the Capitol that day.
Former District of Columbia police officer Michael Finone was violently attacked by rioters at the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th. He calls Trump's proclamation a betrayal.
I have been betrayed by my country, and I've been betrayed by those that supported Donald Trump. Whether you voted for him because he promised these pardons or for some other reason, you knew that this was coming.
Trump has either commuted, pardoned, or pledged to dismiss the cases of more than 1,500 people who took part in the insurrection. They include rioters from extremist groups who were convicted of assaulting police officers that day. Trump claims his supporters were treated unfairly by the legal system. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The new administration is rolling back Biden-era policies that limited where ICE agents could conduct immigration arrests. NPR's Jimena Bustillo has more.
Schools, places of worship, and healthcare facilities were off-limit for arrests of people suspected of being without legal status under a policy from former President Joe Biden. Now the acting Secretary of Homeland Security has rescinded those guidelines, which the Trump administration says limits law enforcement from doing its job. It's not known yet how immigration enforcement agencies will ramp up operations. Trump Border Czar Tom Homan says officials are, quote, back and doing their job effective today, he told CNN in an interview. Still, he declined to provide specific information. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, stocks finished higher. This is NPR. A federal law ensuring homeless students have equal access to education is falling short, especially in rural parts of the Midwest. Kayvon Mansouri has the story.
A Midwest Newsroom investigation found that rural public school districts struggle to identify homeless students who qualify for school services under the McKinney-Vento Act. Part of the reason is a lack of funding and capacity to recognize housing instability. That can mean students staying at a hotel or on a friend's couch. Tara Bach is Missouri's homeless education coordinator.
Our urban school districts might have a team of people working on McKinney-Vento. Those rural school districts probably just have one designated person, and it's probably also the superintendent or the principal or someone else holding other roles.
Last year, the federal government allocated $129 million of McKinney-Vento funding for homeless students in the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Kayvon Mansouri in St. Louis.
President Trump wasted no time issuing an executive order suspending the U.S. TikTok ban for 75 days, even as national security concerns persist. But Trump's legal authority to preserve the popular social media platform is unclear after the Supreme Court unanimously upheld the law. It requires TikTok's Chinese parent company to find a U.S. buyer or be banned from operating here. Trump vowed to keep TikTok going after crediting the app and its users for helping him win re-election. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation,
providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In Gaza, a ceasefire that started Sunday has given Palestinians a chance to return to homes that they fled months ago. NPR producer Anas Baba described this scene in Rafah, a city in southern Gaza on the border with Egypt.
8 months ago, this street was called Paris Street in Rafah. By now, it seems that the Israeli bombardment left nothing from this Champs-Élysées of Rafah. We can see that the infrastructure, the streets, roads, water pipes, every single thing that needs for a human in order to be an inhabitant place is lacking here in Rafah.
It's not clear who will rebuild Gaza, who will manage the territory, or even whether this ceasefire will hold. To help us answer some of those questions, Israel's ambassador to the UN, Danny Danone, joins us now. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me, Ari.
President Trump is taking credit for the ceasefire agreement, and you have praised his administration. What specifically did he or his team do that made a difference in getting this deal?
We thank both administrations, Trump's administration and Biden administration, for working together on this particular issue. And you know politics very well. To see both administrations aligning and working together, it's rare. And I think the fact that we had the support of President Biden and his team, and President-elect Trump at the time and his team, it helped us to reach this framework for the release of the hostages.
I know as an ambassador, as a diplomat, you do not want to alienate either side. Before Joe Biden left the White House, he said that this deal was not meaningfully different from one that was on the table last summer.
This was the deal that I outlined for the world back in May 31st. Many of you covered it at the time.
Ambassador, do you agree with that description? And if it is effectively the same deal, why did the fighting continue for more than half a year longer?
So a few points. First of all, it's not the same deal. It's a similar deal. But the number of the hostages that we accepted, we were going to receive, is higher at this deal. And the second point, which is the most important, that Hamas rejected the offers back in May. So I think the fact that now, because of the pressure that we put on the ground and the pressure of the negotiators and the pressure that both President Biden and President Trump put on the negotiators, we saw that the deal happened and we hope it will be completed.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also faced pushback from people in his own government, his own coalition. As you know, extreme far-right Israeli politicians have already resigned or threatened to resign over the ceasefire deal. One of them, Bezalel Smotrich, says he has, quote, demanded and received a commitment from Netanyahu that Israel will return to the battlefield to eliminate Hamas. Is that true? Has Israel committed to return to the battlefield, or is it committed to extending the ceasefire?
So if you go back to the goals of the war that the government approved, is the release of the hostages and to make sure that Hamas is not taking control over Gaza again. So I think what we will have to see once the negotiations will resume, whether we can find an agreement that Hamas will not stay in power, will not have control over the future of the Palestinians in Gaza. Otherwise, we will have to find other ways to ensure that. And by the way, it's not only for our sake or our security, but it's also for the Palestinians themselves. There is no future for Gaza with Hamas.
So are you saying Smotrich is wrong, that Netanyahu has not committed to Israel returning to the battlefield?
Well, if you look at the agreement, it is very clear. The agreement says that if there will be no negotiations, then we can resume the fights. But if we can get with negotiations an agreement that Hamas will not stay in Gaza and allowing other forces to take over and to start to reconstruct Gaza, that should be the goal of everybody. But if Hamas will insist to continue with the incitement of taking the funds of the international community to dig tunnels and to build infrastructure of terror, that's something that we will not allow.
I want to ask you about the plan for reconstruction, because even after more than a year of war, Israel has not released a detailed plan for who will govern Gaza when the war ends. And in fact, even before the war, Israel severely limited the amount of construction materials that were allowed in the Gaza Strip out of concern that Hamas would use them to build tunnels and bunkers. With millions of tons of rubble, who will rebuild this area?
First, let's acknowledge that when we saw what Hamas did with materials that entered or were smuggled into Gaza, they didn't invest them in schools or hospitals. They built a network of terror. I want to remind you that we actually found some of it. You know, the tunnel system in Gaza, it's longer than the subway stations in New York City and London combined. So if you allow
Hamas to stay in
power...
So this is the reason Israel has given for not allowing construction equipment in the Gaza Strip. But the question is, if Israel continues to limit...
As long as Hamas is in power, there will be limitations. As long as Hamas is in power, there will be no reconstruction. So I think the first goal should be to find a way to make sure that Hamas is not running the life of the Gazan people.
And then, who manages the Gaza Strip? Israel has yet to answer that question.
Well, I can tell you that we have no intention to run the Gaza. We have done it in the past. We moved out of Gaza in 2005 completely, by the way.
You've also said the UN should not, and you've raised concerns about the Palestinian Authority. So then who?
Well, first, I want to remind you that we disengaged completely from Gaza in 2005, and we took out all the settlements, and we allowed the Palestinians to run their own life, but it didn't work. Hamas took over, and we saw what happened. I think there should be a few stages. I think there should be support from the international community at the first stage. And in the long run, it should be a leadership that will come from the people in Gaza that will deal with the education and infrastructure and not with terror. That is the real question, whether you can find a genuine leadership that is not inciting against Israel and promoting radical ideas.
You have said that this ceasefire can only progress if Hamas does not control Gaza. And already in the last few days, we have seen men with guns and uniforms and balaclavas in pickup trucks throughout the Gaza Strip as Hamas reasserts its power. President Trump has said he is not confident that this ceasefire will hold. Are you?
Well, I do hope so. You know, we want to see those hostages, and I remind you, we're talking about babies, women who were kidnapped from their homes. It's not the same terrorists that Hamas demanded to release, convicted murderers. So we want it to be completed. We want to see them back home, and hopefully we will see them. You know, we anticipating every day to get the names and to see those faces coming back and reuniting with their families.
Danny Danone is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Ari.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Donald Trump issued a flurry of executive orders yesterday focused on energy production and natural resource development. He aims to roll back policies from the Biden administration that limited drilling or mining on public lands. One order in particular caught our eye because it covers a ton of issues that are all in one single state, and that's Alaska. So we turn now to Liz Ruskin. She is Washington correspondent for Alaska Public Media. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, Liz. So just to start, if you can, I mean, this order covers a lot of ground. Walk us through what's in it.
Yeah, it covers nearly every controversial Alaska land use issue this century. It includes drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, offshore drilling. It calls for a road through a portion of a wildlife refuge, a controversial road, to help the small community of King Cove. And it calls for a natural gas pipeline across Alaska, and a lot more than that. But I should add that just because there's an executive order doesn't mean it's going to happen. Regulations take a long time to be written, and environmental advocates are going to fight a lot of these in court. And then some things require the oil and gas industry to be interested. It calls for more lease sales in the Arctic Refuge, for instance, but the government has already held two lease sales there, and none of the major oil companies have bid.
Interesting. So why do you think there is such a focus on Alaska?
Well, the short answer is because President Biden was very focused on Alaska. He issued some 70 executive orders, making Arctic drilling harder, all kinds of things. And each one infuriated Alaska's Republican leaders. They complained that the Biden administration was locking up Alaska. Governor Dunleavy specifically asked for this order, a single order, on his on Trump's first day. I talked to Alaska Congressman Nick Begich today, and he, of course, is delighted.
In Alaska, what I've been hearing over the last 24 hours, people are thrilled, people are excited, people are optimistic, and they're excited about the opportunity to participate in this broad, exciting national story.
And there's a bigger picture here, too. Alaska has always been the battleground where America fights over conservation versus development. That the modern history of that goes back to the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline in the 1970s.
Liz, I'm just curious, what have you been hearing in terms of reaction from Alaskans?
Well, Alaska's a red state. Trump won it by a substantial margin. A lot of people are cheering this, including major Alaska Native groups. But not all Alaskans feel this way, of course. I spoke to some who are fighting a road to a proposed mining district. And now that controversy is reopened, and they're feeling like they lost years of work.
Quickly, in the short time we have left, the president also signed a separate order to rename the highest peak in North America, now called Denali, which is an Alaska Native name. Trump wants to change it back to Mount McKinley. How do Alaskans feel about that reversal?
Well, we actually have a new poll that says Alaskans oppose the name change to McKinley by a 2-to-1 margin.
Liz Ruskin from Alaska Public Media, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. We're going to hear now from some Americans who watched President Trump's return to office far from the nation's capital. Two NPR correspondents spoke with folks in different parts of the country. And let's start with Stephen Fowler, who watched the inauguration in Florida. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Ari.
Set the scene for us. Where did you watch Trump swearing in?
I was just a few miles down the road from Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club in West Palm Beach, Florida. It's where the Palm Beach County Republican Party hosted a watch party for those people who did not make the trek to D.C. It was cold for Florida, about 60 degrees, but the light rain that fell at the National Croquet Center did not dampen the mood.
It's electric. People are so excited. Everybody's just had enough war, enough with prices. We're tired of being put last.
Diane Doran Cassio was part of the County Republican Executive Committee.
We need at least 12 years to right the wrongs of what has been done the last 4 years.
Trump had 4 years in office, then so did former President Joe Biden. And folks like Janine Milam say that those two contrasting visions for the country in the past made this inauguration extra special to witness because of what American voters chose for the future.
I saw people tearing up. I mean, it was just beautiful to see how excited everybody is to see this new page in our history in the United States and a turn for the better, because the last 4 years were awfully difficult for all of us.
I asked people to describe their feelings about a second Trump term in a few words. There was excitement, hope, opportunity, and an acknowledgement that things won't change overnight.
So we'll see how many roadblocks Trump runs into, but if Trump were allowed to get done what he wants to get done, what he's talked about doing, then I think, we're headed to glory days. I mean, we're here ready for a new start.
And speaking of a new start, Ari, Trump hit the ground running with a slew of executive action on day one yesterday. While a mostly unified Republican Congress is currently debating the best way to pass his other policies.
NPR's Stephen Fowler there. And of course, yesterday also marked Martin Luther King Day. NPR's Don Gagne was at an event in Michigan marking that holiday. Don, tell us what you saw.
A very different scene where I was. First off, the temperature was 4 degrees above zero. I was at a Detroit NAACP event to honor Dr. King, but no surprise that President Trump was the big topic, starting with the opening prayer from the Reverend James Perkins.
Your word tells us that when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice, but when the wicked rule, the people mourn.
This event did also feature joyful performances by a young men's choir and by a Detroit School of Arts dance troupe. Then in the noon hour, the TVs in the room all switched over to a live stream of Trump's inaugural address. Now, mostly this crowd sat and watched in silence, occasionally punctuating the speech with groans and some jeers, including when Trump said his legacy would be as a peacemaker and a unifier. After that, there were speakers in Detroit, including an immigration lawyer, educators, community activists, union officials, like the UAW's Laura Dickerson, who's bracing for anti-union policies from this White House.
We're going to have to dig deep. We're going to make sure that we have the right leaders in place, people who are ready for this time, because there's going to be challenges like we've never seen before.
And for some attendees, frustration showed. I talked with 34-year-old Jermaine Pencil, a business consultant in Detroit.
Did you watch the inaugural address?
I watched a portion of it until I couldn't watch it anymore.
Okay, explain. What sent you out? Was there a moment or was it just?
I can't believe that we as a country are back in this place where we are listening to words and rhetoric that we're supposed to be moving away from.
Detroit NAACP President Reverend Wendell Anthony wrapped up the event by laying out the task ahead. He said Trump does not have the mandate he claims, that he won election with less than 50% of the vote, and Anthony urged people to persist in their activism in the name of Dr. King.
We don't want to leave here agonizing. We must be organizing. That is the greatest tribute that we can make to the drum major for freedom, justice, and equality.
So these activists in Detroit are defiant even as they find their footing in the new Trump era.
That's NPR's Don Gagne, who watched the inauguration in Michigan, and Stephen Fowler, who was in Florida for the event. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When Bob Dylan went electric in 1965, his folk fans infamously booed him on tour. But soon, the five musicians backing him would go on to leave an indelible mark on rock and roll. They simply called themselves The Band. Garth Hudson, the last surviving founding member of the band, died today. He was 87 years old. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has this appreciation.
When Garth Hudson was first invited to join what would become The Band, he initially declined. It was only with a few special conditions, including an extra $10 a week to give everyone else in the band music lessons, that he finally gave in. His request was so his parents would approve of his association with a rock band. Away from my window. After years of backing rockabilly singer Ronnie Hawkins, the group toured with Bob Dylan as he transitioned from acoustic folk to rock and roll. Later, they moved to a house in upstate New York, which they named Big Pink. There, they recorded over 100 songs with Dylan in the basement, released years later as the album The Basement Tapes. Here's guitarist Robbie Robertson speaking to NPR in 2018.
It was mainly Garth Hudson and myself that were figuring out the details of the setup there.
Most importantly, it's where they fleshed out what would become the band's debut solo album, Music from Big Pink. Garth Hudson played the keyboard, accordion, and saxophone, but it was his way of playing the Lowry organ and the clavinet as leading instruments that gave the band's music its signature post-psychedelic, churchy sound. When I get over this mountain, after the band's official disbandment in 1976, Hudson continued playing in several iterations of the group, including this live session with bassist and vocalist Rick Danko for NPR in 1989. In his later years, Hudson was a highly sought-after session musician, working with artists like Norah Jones and Nico Case. Close friend and collaborator Jan Aust told NPR that Hudson died peacefully in his sleep as he approached his 88th year, just like the 88 keys on his beloved piano. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News. Don't leave me alone in the twilight. Twilight is the loneliest time of day.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR.